from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on this special holiday edition of Forum from our archives, first, we'll bring you my interview with Berkeley writer Yaa Jessee discussing her critically acclaimed debut novel, Homegoing. Then at 10:30, Christine Carter from UC Berkeley's Greater Good Science Center talks about her book, The Sweet Spot, How to Find Your Groove at Home and Work. It's coming up next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Yaa Jessee's highly praised debut novel, Homegoing, covers seven generations and three centuries of two African half-sisters and their descendants. Born in Ghana and raised in Huntsville, Alabama, Yaa Jessee graduated from Stanford and then completed an MFA at the Iowa Writers Workshop under a Dean's Graduate Research Fellowship. She presently resides in Berkeley, and she joins us for this Forum Hour. And welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Delighted to have you. And this is an extraordinary achievement, this book, especially for a debut novel, and congratulations on it.
Thank you.
I'd like to begin by talking with you about the genesis of it. I mean, you actually left Ghana when you were 2 years old, but you went back and visited an old fort, which was a symbol of slavery. It kind of gives new meaning to upstairs, downstairs, and we'll talk about that.
Right.
But it's on the Gold Coast, and it's really sort of the genesis of this novel, wasn't it?
Yeah, so in 2009, my sophomore year at Stanford, I received a fellowship called the Chapaluji that they give to sophomore students to complete a research or creative project between their sophomore and junior years. And I knew I wanted to use mine to write a novel. I'd had a different idea in mind initially. I thought I'd go to my mother's hometown, which is in the central region of Ghana, a place that I hadn't spent very much time in, and just kind of see if anything struck me. Nothing really did, but a friend came to visit and kind of, you know, in thinking of more touristy things to do with him, we decided to go see the Cape Coast Castle, which was something that I had never done before, never really paid much thought to before. Obama was actually in Ghana that summer, too, and he had just visited it. So I think that was where the idea kind of came from. But it was while in the castle on this tour that the tour guide started to talk to us about how the British soldiers who lived and worked in the castle used to marry the local women, which was something I didn't know anything about. And then from there, he took us down to see the dungeons. And I pretty much immediately knew that this was what I wanted to write about.
This was the genesis, really, of the novel. Did you know that you'd want to write also about the slave trade and particularly the controversial subject of the complicity of tribal members in the slave trade?
Yes, I think so. I mean, the tour guide, I think, did an excellent job of kind of talking to us about different Ghanaian ethnic groups' involvement in the slave trade. And, you know, myself, my family, my mother is a Fanti and my father is an Ashanti. So those are the two groups that I focus on in the book. And those are the two that the tour guide kind of talked to us most about, in part because we were in Fanti land at the time. And it was just so fascinating to me that my mother could have grown up, you know, 50 miles from this castle and never really engaged with slavery in a kind of meaningful way, a way that was meaningful enough to kind of have discussions with her children about it. That struck me as odd, I guess, having grown up here where you do learn about slavery in school versus Ghana where you don't. And I felt like, you know, to have this monument to slavery be on Ghanaian land, but not really talk about the Ghanaians' role in building and maintaining it felt like it would kind of do a disservice to the novel.
And where did the idea of two sisters, half-sisters, come from? I mean, because they hardly even know each other, know of each other, but there's a great sense of an epic here because it goes on from generation to generation, and you begin with these two who have totally different trajectories in terms of their relationship to slavery.
Yes. I mean, the idea for the two sisters came about during that tour. Again, when the tour guide talked to us about how the British soldiers married local women, I think that was maybe my first realization that there was some kind of connection between the locals and the British in any kind of meaningful way. And so I was really struck by the idea that there could be these free Ghanaian women walking above these captives underneath, and the idea that two of them could be related felt really interesting to me, and to kind of be able to watch that family line split off and see the directions that it might take.
So you just followed your curiosity and your imagination.
Exactly. Exactly right.
But you did a lot of research, and I want to get into some of that here. In fact, I mean, you know, it begins, and a lot of novelists write about a novel beginning with an image, and you begin by telling us about this fire.
Yes.
One of the sisters' father is preserving the yams, and, you know, just
right.
In those kinds of details. I mean, the raising of yams, the marrying off of daughters, the way the multiple wives were in separate huts, all
yeah.
of the kinds of things that men in trying to find a wife would bring, like the fish in their nets
right.
and so
yeah.
forth. I mean, a lot of research.
Yeah, yeah. This book took an incredible amount of research. I think, in fact, during that trip to Ghana, in my journal on the first day, I wrote something like, "I'm scared of how much research this book is going to take." So I was kind of aware.
How'd you overcome that daunting fear?
I just took it one step at a time. You know, it took me 7 years to write, and I wrote it chronologically. And I did that so that I could kind of break up each generation and kind of figure out how to go about researching that particular section. So so it didn't overwhelm me. I didn't try to, you know, do it all at once and then write from there. I did it as I went along.
Well, you take us into a lot of human places, but also a lot of dark places. I mean,
right.
misogyny and racism and slavery, and also early on domestic violence. I mean, where
right.
Man is beating his wife and his wife is beating the kid, and
yeah.
so it goes. How did that come from the research, or did it come more from, you know, what you read in the newspapers day after day?
Right. I mean, I think it was a combination of both. I knew pretty early on that I wanted this book to be about the legacy of slavery, not just slavery in the 18th century, but also kind of what slavery has left us today, both for Ghanaians and Americans. And because of that, I knew that I would be going into ideas of racism and misogyny and those kinds of aspects that kind of trail off from something this big. But yeah, I think it was a combination of, again, my curiosities and things that I've read about and things that I've heard of, and also just kind of paying attention to human stories.
But the breadth and the scope of the novel is really what astounded me as a reader. I mean, mm. you have not only the legacy of slavery, and I'm suspecting you probably read Isabel Wilkerson, because you
yes.
take us all the way. You take us from Middle Passage. You take us to Harlem. You take us, you know, to the heroin addiction in Harlem and so
right.
forth, to the Great Migration that Wilkerson writes about. The mm. scope of this is epic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I did read Wilkerson, actually, after I'd finished the novel, ironically enough. But yeah, I loved the idea of having a book that kind of made an attempt to connect the dots in a way that makes it clear that so many of the things that we're seeing in the present didn't appear out of thin air. You know, they kind of have these precedences. And so for me, writers like Wilkerson with her book, The Warmth of Other Suns, and also Michelle Alexander with The New Jim Crow, and something like Ta-Nehisi Coates' The Case for Reparations, these writers who are taking a more long view of history was something that really fascinated me and something that I hoped to do with this book.
Yeah, you were kind of fascinated and surprised and probably delighted when Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote something about you.
Oh, yeah. That was one of the highlights of this year, certainly, was seeing that blurb from Ta-Nehisi. I had no idea that he even had the book, and so I think I first encountered it when he was tweeting about it. A friend texted my boyfriend, and we ended up on Twitter just going through his kind of live tweets of his reading experience. It was pretty incredible.
What a great feeling, especially since it was a surprise. It's almost...
Yes.
I don't know what would be more comparable, except maybe when LeVar Burton sent you a signed certificate for a story you wrote. Let's go back to that for a moment, because a lot of listeners are perhaps too young to remember even the name LeVar Burton, but he was the star of Roots, you know, which had an enormous impact on television land and on American TV watchers, probably on you too.
I actually have never seen Roots, so I have to say LeVar Burton for me was heroic because of his work in Reading Rainbow, which I used to watch every day religiously. We didn't have cable growing up, so I really could only watch the PBS shows. And I remember...
It probably maybe made you a better writer.
I'm pretty sure it did. But I loved reading so much, and I loved that program so much. And they had a competition called the Reading Rainbow Young Writers and Illustrators Competition. And I wrote a story for it when I was 7. It's called Just Me and My Dog. And LeVar Burton signed a certificate and sent it back to me. And I think that was really kind of, you know, the beginnings of all of this for me.
You get that validation, it sets you in motion.
Yeah, exactly.
Growing up in Alabama, though, I mean, let's talk about that. Because, you know, the legacies in Alabama that you grew up with, I mean, you must have to some extent absorbed some of them under the Wallace years. I mean, you're too young for that, but certainly... Yeah. The whole realization that this was a Jim Crow society and this was a separatist society.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we moved to Alabama when I was 9, actually. So we had lived in from Ghana. We went to Ohio, Columbus, Ohio, and then Illinois, Tennessee, and then Alabama. And I think the first thing that struck me and my family about being in Alabama was just kind of the lack of West African immigrants, because in every place prior, we'd at least had some like large community of other Ghanaians, other Nigerians to be around. And in Alabama, there was this kind of absence of that. And then on top of that, we ended up living in a predominantly white neighborhood. So it was also our first time of isolation by race, too. So isolated by race and isolated by ethnicity. And I think very early on, I started to realize that Alabama was unlike any of the other places I had lived in, just because of the fact that it is one of those places where the legacy of slavery is still so strongly felt. And so that kind of, I think, set into motion, I guess, a lot of the questions and the things that I interrogate in this book.
If you've just joined us, we're talking to Jessie, and her debut novel is Homegoing, and it's been much praised, and it was a notable book on the New York Times list for the year 2016. You used the word interrogate. I mean, do you see yourself as an interrogator? And I mean, it's a strong word connotatively.
Yeah, I think one of the great things that writing can do is to interrogate, to kind of ask questions, not necessarily to answer them, but to kind of lay bare all of these questions that you might have. And for me, I think Homegoing is really kind of just a mixture of so many of the questions that I've had growing up about, again, about race, about ethnicity, about time, and writing in a way, again, that doesn't really answer those questions, but that attempts to ask them.
Well, a good novel does that. I mean, it presses us with all kinds of pressing questions. Let me ask you about answers, though, just for a moment, because it used to be that novelists were asked their opinion about just...
Yeah.
I mean they were often, well-trained at giving responses, and all the research you've done. Where do you have a position? I'm just going to ask you forthrightly about whether reparations should be paid because of slavery, because you've delved so deeply into the legacy of slavery, you immerse yourself into it.
Yes, I mean, I think that reparations should be paid. I think, obviously, again, the case for reparations that Ta-Nehisi Coates, I think, was a very convincing piece. And I think one of the reasons why it's important is because it lays out the ways in which we have not addressed slavery properly in this country. And so much of what we're seeing in the present, I think, are these offshoots of horrible policy that's lasted over not just decades, but centuries. And in order to try to begin to make amends for that, or to begin to kind of change the direction, the course of race relations in this country, I think, you know, we have to make an actual kind of physical manifestation of progress, and reparations could be that.
Although the difficulty is how much reparations, and if you give reparations to Africans, do you give reparations to Native Americans?
Sure. It raises a bunch of other questions, but I think it should at least be considered.
And, you know, I couldn't help thinking, especially in reading the novel when it takes place in Africa, of Chinua Achebe. And I don't know if he was an influence on you, but I suspect you mentioned Ghana and Nigeria together and so forth. Had you read Achebe?
Yes, I did. I read Things Fall Apart in college, I believe. And it's, you know, it's one of the great pieces of literature, for any country, but certainly for Nigerians, for West Africans, Achebe is kind of, the standard of what West African literature can be. And I adored that book.
He's a great icon of that. You also adored Marquez's book.
Yes.
Big influence on you, too.
Yes. I read 100 Years of Solitude right before I set out to write this book. And one of the great gifts of that novel for a writer, I think, is that you feel as though Garcia Marquez is so free. You know, he's expansive, and he kind of allows himself to try new things, to do things that you probably would be told in a writing class to never do, such as naming every character the same name.
Well, Faulkner does that too.
Sound
and the Fury, Quentin and Quentin.
Right.
But so you were kind of moving against the grain of conventional codes there in your mind?
Well, I was hoping to. I knew that I was writing a book that that would take place over such a long time period. And not only that, not only to have like a multi-generational perspective, but a book that kind of marches forward in time and never goes back. And that was something that I didn't really know how to do. And so 100 Years of Solitude was great in that I felt like it was a way of taking permission, I guess.
I guess we're getting into the whole realm of literary influences. And for people who are not necessarily acquainted with some of these works, that may not necessarily be as exciting for those who are. But I couldn't help thinking of Toni Morrison reading you, too, particularly
yeah.
Song of Solomon.
Yeah. Song of Solomon is my favorite book, I think, of all time. I read it when I was 17. In an AP literature class in Alabama, and it was the first book by a Black woman that I had ever been assigned and really that I had ever read. And so I was so struck by, first of all, by the fact that people who looked like me could have this profession that I had kind of thought about my whole life, but never really understood that that you could do it for a living. And so that amazed me. And then just the sheer power and beauty of that book really struck me. And she's a big influence on me.
And I was struck by a number of things, but let me go back to Africa and the slave trade. When Afia, for example, who opens the novel, first lays eyes on a white man, I mean, you're there. You are seeing things from her point of view, and you're making your reader see things from her point of view. It's the first white man she's ever laid eyes on.
Right.
And the idea of, I mean, it's almost like Brave New World or something along those lines. It's arresting to her, and it's arresting to us as readers. How do you put yourself in that kind of mindset?
Right. I mean, that's the great challenge, I think, of writing characters, to figure out how to inhabit, I guess, the world of your character in a way that allows the reader to inhabit that world. And for Afia, I think one of the things that I was thinking about was the fact that, you know, she's living in this kind of isolated village, but this village that is attempting to kind of become greater. And in becoming greater, it's decided to be a part of the slave trade. And so that kind of puts her and her village in contact with white people for the first time in a significant way. And so that's kind of where I start, is thinking about what that might feel like, what that might mean, and go from there.
You really seem to be also very set on giving these characters a kind of full dimensionality. By that, I mean, E.M. Forster a long time ago in Aspects of the Novel. And I think this is, by the way, is this a novel or a number of short stories interrelated? I think you could make the latter argument, couldn't you?
Some people have. For me, it was always a novel. It was always novelistic in scope, and I never imagined it as a collection of short stories.
But I was talking about Forrester because he talks about rounded characters, making the characters multidimensional, giving them nuance, giving them really sometimes very contradictory traits and traits which in some instances as a reader, thoughtful reader, really disapproves of
right.
and strongly disapproves of.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't want any character in this book to be black or white, you know, or to have this kind of this moralistic way of saying these are the good people and these are the bad people. I felt like that isn't true. That isn't true to human nature at all. So you can have a character like Governor James, who is the governor of this Cape Coast castle, who is kind of the one who is deciding who and where to sell these slaves to. And so in that way, he's kind of a dark figure. And yet when you see the way that he loves his wife, Afia, for example, he becomes more complicated and that character kind of gains depth. And so thinking about that there are people who are both good and bad, who make decisions that they think are right for reasons that we understand, even if we don't understand the decisions themselves. I think that's one way to kind of get to rounding out a character.
You know, there are those who would argue, you know, any slave owner should be presented as Simon Legree or some dreadful character. But Thomas Jefferson was a slave owner. I mean, you know, there's all that sense of the complicated nature of humanity. And I think you get at that in a really original and thoughtful way. You get criticized, though, for essentially revealing the African complicity in the slave trade. Have you heard any blowback on that?
Oh, yes. There's certainly been pushback to that, I think, particularly, again, among West Africans who aren't used to having that information kind of out there. And I understand the impulse in part because there is a fear, I guess, that that people can use that to kind of blame you for the slave trade and kind of shift the blame, but I don't see it that way. I see it as a way of kind of, again, complicating the narrative. And if this truth exists, why should it be hidden?
Well, there has been a lot of argument about that, as I'm sure you know, by scholars. I'm thinking about people like Henry Louis Gates and Cornel West, about just how much that complicity ought to be brought into the light, and especially in light of black nationalism. It's not only African, of course, it's African American.
Right. Yeah. I mean, for me, I think trying to keep in mind the fact that even while these Gold Coast people were exploiting each other, they were simultaneously being exploited. That kind of nuance, that kind of complexity of the situation, I think, is important to recognize, so that you're not just simply ascribing blame to one party or the other.
Carl tweets, most of the exported slaves were not from the local tribes or even Ghana. Perhaps it made it easier for them to be thought of as the other.
Well, I think that has something to do with this. A lot of times I'll hear people say things like, I can't believe that Africans sold each other. And that assumes this kind of connectivity or this idea of thinking about Africans as having an each other. And I think for many people, certainly on the Gold Coast at that time, they were used to thinking about their different ethnic groups, not necessarily thinking in a racial way that kind of blended all black people together. And so you could sell those people over there and not think about it as having anything to do with you and your people here. So I think that, again, kind of makes the situation a little more complex than maybe we're used to thinking about it here in America, where things are very racially configured.
You've been listening to a special encore edition of Forum. Our guest was Berkeley writer Yah Jesse, discussing her critically acclaimed debut novel, Homegoing. Stay with us for another program from our archives this holiday season.